Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You might remember Dallas and Fort Worth before interstate freeways sliced through town. Maybe your grandparents told you about vast expanses of blackland prairie in places that today are highly developed urban zones. But long before humans roamed this area, before humans even existed, Texas lay at the bottom of the sea. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The fact is that all of North America has been under construction for billions of years now, and what feels very permanent and settled from a human timescale is just a passing moment in the geologic history of the continent. Kirk Johnson is here to share some remarkable stories about what we know of that history. He is the SANT director of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History and host of the PBS Nova series Making North America. The three-part series continues tonight on KERA-TV. Kirk, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks so much, Chris. It's great to be here.
You've said geology has done a disservice to itself by being so boring. What is different about the way geology is communicated in this series?
Well, what we try and stay away from jargon entirely and take people right out to the rocks and show them not only the rocks, these amazing places like Grand Canyon or Zion or various spots around the nation and the continent, but we also show them how those rocks got to be there and what those rocks are made of. So it's a very dynamic show where I'm being dropped off of cliffs and rocks are exploding in front of me. It's kind of fun.
One of the things I love is you rappel down into the Grand Canyon from the rim and you say it's like descending into a time machine.
Oh, yeah, because there's, you know, the canyons in places 4,000 feet deep. So you have these layer after layer after layer of rocks. And the basic law in geology is the lower you go in the stack, the older you get. So you're going back in time as you rappel down the cliff.
Why are there not canyons surrounding every powerful river?
Well, you know what happens? The canyons are formed when the gradient changes. So the sea level can drop or the land can rise. So it makes the rivers steeper. And then the rivers just cut like a knife and they just cut right down. And that whole area of the Colorado Plateau was uplifted about 10 million years ago, and the Colorado River just sawed its way down and made the Grand Canyon. So you could have one of those in Texas if you pump Oklahoma up into the sky, for instance.
We're not going to lift Oklahoma any higher than it already is. At the very bottom of the rocks in the Grand Canyon are some rocks that were formed 1.7 billion years ago. Where did they come from?
Well, so this is sort of the interesting question. You take on this challenge, which we did, which is where did North America come from and how long has it been around? It's a pretty interesting question. You start to realize that North America was assembled by chunks of little microcontinents that came together around 1.7, 1.8 billion years. And what you see in the bottom of the Grand Canyon are remnants of some of those original chunks that came together and formed the core of North America about half an Earth ago.
It's so odd to think about volcanoes all over what is today the continental United States, but in fact, there were very, very powerful eruptions for millions of years on end.
Yeah, you know, there are places all around the country where there have been eruptions. And at the Smithsonian, we have a thing called the Global Volcanism Program, and we're tracking every live volcano in the world. There's about 1,540 of them. And we call a volcano live if it's erupted any time in the last 10,000 years. And you might think that's a long time, but volcanoes can kind of sleep for a while then blow up like Mount St. Helens did in 1980. But you can go further back in time and find volcanoes that had happened and then just left their lava. And you can, there's lots of that evidence. And in the show, we visit a place called Gooseberry Falls up right in the northern Great Lakes where North America, which had formed at 1.8 billion years, started to rip apart and make this great big gash called the Mid-Continental Rift. And as that happened, lava just poured into that thing. So what we have now is this giant scar tissue, about a 1,000-mile trend of lava that in places is 30 miles deep and many miles wide. And it's just evidence of an ancient, horrible time when you would have been in Iowa or Minnesota. It would have been a really dynamic place to be.
So, of course, we're not just walking around on lava. We're not just walking around on things that came directly from a volcano. How did we end up with so much granite at the surface?
Granite, you know, this is the interesting thing about continents is that most people don't think about continents too much, but continents float. They float on the heavier rock of the oceanic crust of the Earth. And so once you have a continent, it's sort of like an air mattress floating on a pool. It can float around on the surface of the pool, but it's not going to sink into the pool. And granite is that continental rock that's a little bit lighter than the rock that makes the ocean crust. And so it's one of the rocks that makes the continent buoyant. And as you erode, say if you take a rain over time and you erode the tops of mountains off, you've reduced weight from the top of the continent, so the continent actually lifts up. It climbs into the sky. So as erosion happens, mountains actually grow because the continent is buoyant.
Speaking of erosion, we associate Manhattan with skyscrapers. At one time, there were mountains towering over the landscape there.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's so cool about geology is that you have so much time to work with. The planet is 4.56 billion years old, and that's just an awful lot of time. And you can erode a mountain range at a rate of 1 millimeter per year and still have plenty of time to erode them down to nothing. And so there are lots of places in the world which are the roots of ancient mountain ranges that are no longer there. And New York City is one of those places. So it's kind of fun to go to the city, dig into the bedrock, which anchors all the skyscrapers, and say, here was the bottom. This is the root system of this massive mountain range that used to be here 400 million years ago. It's gone now, but it's what made the city so stable, having that really strong, tough rock beneath it.
When that early version of North America, like North America 1.0, started to split apart, it eventually stopped. Why?
If you think about the planet, all these continents floating around like the air mattress is floating on a pool, they slowly bang towards each other, and sometimes they tear apart, sometimes they come together. And as the rift was opening, at the same time, other continents were moving in to sort of buttress North America from the sides. And we don't really know why that rift stopped, but it looks like what happened after the rift was starting to form was all the continents did come together to form this gigantic supercontinent. Every single continent on the planet was together in one mass called Rodinia. And it seems like that's probably what put the kibosh on the ripping of North America in half.
And, of course, Rodinia came before Pangaea?
That's right. That's sort of the fate of the planet is that continents come together, form supercontinents, and then they split apart. And we're in a time right now when they're sort of splitting apart. If you wait 175 million years, they'll all be back together again.
And what made Pangaea so inherently unstable?
Well, Pangaea had a couple of interesting things. It was the supercontinent that was around about 300 million years ago, and it had all the continents. It spanned the equator, and it was so big that Earth, you know, heat coming from the Earth was trapped under this buoyant continent. And that's probably one of the reasons it started to rip apart, is it starts to gain heat and energy beneath the continent. And eventually these rifts do open up, and the classic rift, of course, is the Atlantic Ocean opened up like a zipper opening up. And you even look across the Atlantic today, you can see that South America and Africa and North America and Europe all kind of fit together if you slide them back together. And in fact, they were together as recently as 200 million years ago.
It's odd to think of the Rocky Mountains coming and going multiple times. They just seem like something that has always been there.
When you're a person and you look at a mountain range, you say, wow, that is a huge thing. They're very awesome. They're much bigger than you are. They're made out of rocks. They look pretty permanent. I mean, people look at mountain ranges and think, oh, the thing's been there forever. But if you just look at the processes that are going on, the mountains are eroding pretty rapidly. You have big landslides, and there's a lot of weather up on tops of mountains. And the mountains get ground down pretty fast. So left to their own devices, mountains do get worn away to nothing. They're like pushing a pencil up into a pencil sharpener. And the Rocky Mountains have a nice story because they've come up a couple of times. They came up first about 300 million years ago when they were part of a mountain range that actually stretched across into Arkansas. And then that mountain range got worn down to nothing, got buried. In fact, it got deeply buried. The tops of those mountains were 10,000 feet beneath the surface of what is now Colorado. Then about 70 million years ago, Colorado punched up and you get another version of the Rockies. And that one weathers down and buries itself. And at about 10 million years ago, you had a third one. And that's the one we see today. So mountain ranges are kind of unreliable. I think they're pretty ephemeral, personally.
I have to ask, are you somehow able to get your head around geologic time now better than the rest of us? And was there a point in your academic career when suddenly you thought, okay, this is no longer too big for me to conceive?
Yeah, there's two points on that. One is people always say, I can't think, how can you think in millions of years? And I think, well, you can think in millions of dollars pretty easily, so why not millions of years? That's the first one. People have no problems with lots of money, but they have lots of problems with lots of time. But the second thing is that if you go out and observe things happening and see evidence of those things happening over long periods of time, you're like, okay, here's how it works. You might find, for instance, there are places in Utah that we visited where there's cliffs that are several thousand feet high that are composed up of the layered mud from the bottom of ponds. And you can go look at ponds today and see how fast they fill up with mud. And so you find that much pond mud, like, okay, there was a lot of time that happened in that one place to deposit all that pond mud. So it's really a matter of looking at modern processes like how streams work, how sand dunes form, how beaches work. Then you start to say, oh, okay, these same processes have been happening ever since there's been an earth. There's always been beaches and rivers and mountains. And if you observe the modern ones, you can then make estimates looking at the old ones, and you can sort of put together the actual chronology and history of the whole planet.
People who live in Texas are aware that large parts of Texas were once covered by water. Where did that water come from?
Well, if you think about it, the continent is big. North America right now is about 10 million square miles, and it's wrapped around the globe, and it's moving. So if it flexes down just a little bit, I mean, it's a big place, and if it flexes down a few thousand feet, parts of it go under sea level. And when that happens, the sea floods onto the continent. And about 100, 110 million years ago, the middle part of North America depressed in this great north-south trough, and the sea flooded in from what is now the Gulf of Mexico and from what is now the Arctic Ocean and formed a north-south seaway that completely inundated places like Kansas and most of Texas, actually. The seaway was about 1,000 miles wide, so you go from, you get on your boat in Utah and sail across to sort of Indianapolis. That'd be the width of the seaway, probably about 600 feet deep. And we know it was there because the mud from the bottom of the seaway is full of marine fossils. And you in Dallas are on top of a formation called the Austin Chalk, which is chock-a-block full of Cretaceous marine fossils, ammonites and fish and sharks and plesiosaurs and other marine reptiles. So the evidence is really literally in the backyards of Dallas and Fort Worth.
The first time I ever saw a large ammonite, like out in the wild, it was in this creek bed in Fort Worth, which it clearly hadn't lived in the creek itself that exists today.
Exactly. Well, you know, the landscapes change. What was the bottom of the sea now becomes a backyard in Dallas.
And so everything is always changing. And of course, the shape of what is now North America is a relatively recent development.
Yeah, and if you think about the continent, it's basically got Alaska, Panama, and Greenland. Those are the three corners of the triangle of North America. So it's a big triangular wedge. And that original core of North America that formed about 1.7 billion years ago is a lump in the middle of that. And after that formed, a whole bunch of stuff got slapped onto the east side, and then a whole bunch of stuff got slapped onto the west side. And that's basically the story of North America. But we're still appending things onto the west side of North America. You look at places like Southeast Alaska, where mountain ranges are being pushed up because chunks of the Pacific Ocean are being driven into the North American continent and being slapped onto the side and making it wider.
And out in Hawaii, which does Hawaii count as part of North America?
Oh, absolutely not. You're good to catch that one. We we were flew to Hawaii. I'm like, guys, there's no way we can convince anybody that Hawaii is part of North America. I mean, technically, the North American plate goes to the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, so the western half of Iceland is on the North American plate, but there's not on the North American continent, but there's just no way. I mean, Hawaii is out in the Pacific Ocean. We went there just to get some really good shots of Mount Kilauea erupting because when you want to make a continent, you have to start with something. And you start with volcanic islands. So Hawaii is a good place to start.
We're speaking this hour with Kirk Johnson. He is SANT Director of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History and host of the NOVA program, Making North America. The three-part series continues tonight on KERA television. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask your favorite geology question. Now's the time. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet. I'm @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History and host of the NOVA three-part series, Making North America. It continues tonight on KERA television. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Kirk, you traveled with some fossil hunters to Alaska and made some really remarkable finds, equatorial corals and a fossilized palm leaf. How on earth did they get there?
Well, you know, this whole thing that the continent has moving plates and that continents are moving, in the 80s you started to realize that little chunks of land could move as well, small islands or small islands the size of Japan, for instance. So you could imagine a situation where plants and animals were living on an island in the tropics. They live, die, become buried, becomes fossilized, and then that island continues drifting somewhere. And in the case of the Northwest East Pacific, a lot of those land masses get shoved up into the corner of Alaska. And as a result, when you look for fossils in Alaska, you find a lot of things that used to be living near the equator. But on the show, we made an amazing discovery. It wasn't planned. It was just pure, fabulous luck. We were digging on a beach about near Sitka, Alaska. And I had seen some fossil leaves on this beach before, but I had no idea what we were about to find. And we were cracking these big rocks open, and I found a little tiny bit of a palm frond. And I thought, wow, it would be so cool if we could get a palm frond on camera on this beach in Alaska. And we were racing the tide, and we finally cracked this great big slab of rock up, and there was an entire palm frond on that rock. And very interesting, because that was a part of Alaska that was already in place at when that palm frond was living and dying. So that was a bona fide Alaskan palm frond, one that was living when the world was much warmer, when Alaska was a forested place rather than a more of a colder place like it is today.
How long have scientists understood this idea that land masses are moving slowly but constantly? Did the first people who came upon fossils like these just jump to the wrong conclusions?
Oh, yeah. No, there was a couple of people around 1915 who were thinking, hey, these continents might be moving. But that theory did not gain widespread acceptance until the late 60s. There was a meeting in 1967 where enough new data was presented, like, oh, wow, the continents actually are moving. So very heady times in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s when we realized that all the paradigms of geology had to be rebooted with the concept that continents moved laterally. And they can move quite fast. I mean, they can move up to several inches a year.
And it would seem like geology and biology are entirely different disciplines, but clearly the formation of land and bodies of water has a lot to do with the evolution of living things.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, we live on planet Earth, and there's two things here. There's the Earth and there's life, and they're in close interaction. And you need to look no further than the dirt in the back of your yard, because soil is where biology and geology are completely intertwined. And that's what underpins all of our agriculture, the fact that moisture and animals and fungus have broken up the rock, released the nutrients, and made soil, which allows us to grow plants. And that's just one example of how life influences rock. And there's lots of examples of how rock influenced life. And so that was part of the back and forth that we went to in the show. In the episode that's going to play tonight, we went to the Bahamas and dove on this amazing reef of very weird lump-like mounds called stromatolites. And these are the formations that are made by the earliest forms of life on Earth. And these things have been around the planet for at least 3.5 billion years, so 3/4 of the Earth's history. And one of the characteristic properties of stromatolites is that the microbes that live in them are photosynthetic, which means they generate oxygen. And these are basically small microbes that are making the planet habitable for animals that come down the road.
So before the stromatolites formed and somehow thrived in these pretty inhospitable conditions, not too much else that we recognize as an earthly life form could live.
Yeah, imagine a planet where we have an atmosphere, but it's got no oxygen in it. And that would be a problem for animals, for sure. And, you'd have to, plants need the carbon dioxide, but they also need oxygen as part of their cycle. So it's this pre-animal plant world that these stromatolites harken back to.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Mike in Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
I got two unrelated quick questions. One is I took my daughter to couple of years ago to the Petrified Forest, and they said these trees had been lying there for 25 million years. I'm just wondering how did they just really sit there undisturbed for 25 million years, because they left them allegedly in the positions where they found them. And the second unrelated question is, in the old days of oil, in the very first, you know, century ago, were there actually lakes of oil under the ground, just, you know, pools of oil collected underground? That's my two questions. Thank you.
Thanks,
okay,
the
first question about petrified forest is a fun question. When you go there, there are these beautiful, bright red, huge petrified logs, and there used to be wood, but they've been replaced by silica, so they're nice, brilliant red agate. And they're all lying on their side. So the first thing is that place is misnamed. It should be called Petrified Logjam National Monument, not Petrified Forest, because they're not standing up like a forest would be standing up. And those trees were living about 210 million years ago. They're really old, old things. They lived, died, got buried in sediment, and only recently did that sediment erode to make the badlands and expose those trees. So those trees have been lying in the ground, buried, since 210 million years ago, but they didn't come to the surface until the last few thousands of years. And that's when people arrived and saw them lying willy-nilly all across the landscape, eroding out of the badlands. And the badlands there are made of a soft rock, which erodes away rapidly, but the trees themselves are very hard agate, so they're persistent and they lie in the landscape. So they're a nice little story. And then pools of oil, I mean, most oil is found in rock itself. It's found in sandstone or shale. So it's the, if you imagine a jar full of sand, if I gave you a glass full of sand and said, is the glass full of sand? You'd say, yes, it is. And if I had a glass full of water and said, how much water could I pour into the glass full of sand? You'd say, I don't know. And you can usually pour in half a glass full of water into a glass that's already full of sand because there's space in between the sand grains. And most oil and gas lives in the space between sand grains and deeply buried layers. So it's not technically a pool. Now, there are occasional examples where underground caves fill up with oil and water. So there actually are kind of underground pools and lakes. But that's pretty rare. That happens in limestone sometimes. But most oil is just in the space between the sand grains.
So often we hear about excavations of, you know, human sites or animals that died relatively recently. How is it that while mountains are eroding and sort of being exposed at the ground level, we have other things being buried so pretty quickly over the course of thousands of years?
Yeah, and I like to look at the world in two ways. There's two kinds of places. What I call E-world or erosion world, that is where landscape is going up and erosion is happening. And D world, where the land is actually settling and sinking and deposition is occurring. So a good example of D world would be the area around New Orleans, Louisiana, all the bayou country. That area is actually sinking into the earth. The sea is coming in, but the Mississippi is bringing more sediment down, and it just sort of layer after layer is piling up. So that's an example of a place where layers are being piled up. A place where layers are being ripped away are the Rocky Mountains, where the mountains are high, the weather scrapes stuff away. So you wouldn't be forming fossils in the Rocky Mountains, but you are forming them in Louisiana. And the trick is, once you've formed them, how do you get them back out again? And it turns out that sometimes places that were sinking and accumulating layers stop sinking, start going up and eroding. And when that happens, you get fossils like the Petrified Forest coming out in exposures.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Rita is on the line next in Irving. Hello, Rita.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have a two-part question. My first question is there any truth to California breaking off from the U.S.? And my second question is, when we first had Pangea, the continent started spreading apart and breaking apart. Is it going to be that North America is going to crash into China? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Good questions, both. We actually, in the first episode, we talk about what happens to California. And there's a long fault called the San Andreas Fault, which slices off the edge of the sort of southwest edge of California. And the fault comes in from the ocean just north of San Francisco, and it drives along. And then once it gets to Los Angeles, it sort of dives inland and goes in towards the Salton Sea. And anything that's outboard or towards the Pacific Ocean of that fault is sliding north relative to North America. And that whole slice is eventually going to slide north and kind of out to sea. But before that happens, Los Angeles is going to pull up right next to San Francisco, which is kind of an odd concept. But then that slice will just keep on going right out into the ocean. So a bit of California will eventually drive off into the Pacific Ocean. And in terms of Pangaea, what is the question about Pangaea again, Chris?
Will North America and China eventually collide?
You know what? It looks like what's going to happen is that you would think that's the case, as North America is kind of moving to the west right now. But if you project forward the plates, and there's some great scientists, including one in Texas, UT Arlington, Chris Scotese, who has projected the continents of where they're going to be, eventually what's going to happen is North America is going to slow down, and then it will collide back into Eurasia on the east side and make a new supercontinent. And you can go to a couple of websites and look at the drifting of the continents. It's pretty fun to play them backwards and forwards, like giant bumper cars.
You call North America a dinosaur factory, and this is not like American exceptionalism. We actually do have an inordinate number of dinosaurs that lived and died here.
Yeah, you know, you think about what I was talking about, how you make fossils. You need lots of deworld, lots of deposition to accumulate the fossils. Then you need lots of erosion to expose them. And if you've exposed them, it's really good to not have too many plants at the surface, because if you have modern plants, you can't see the rocks and find the fossils. And the third ingredient is to have lots of paleontologists to go look for them. And North America has all of that. It's got the great layers of rock deposited during the dinosaur times. It's got uplifts of that have lifted those rocks back into the sky. The arid west of North America is just lots of badlands and bare exposures. And we've been looking for dinosaurs here pretty aggressively since the 1860s, and lots of different paleontologists. So we're finding new dinosaurs several per year, new species of dinosaurs several per year. And in the show, we visit a place called the Kaparowitz Plateau, which is down by just north of the Grand Canyon in southern Utah. And it's a vast area that's just very inaccessible. It's very steep and rugged, and there's no roads into it. We flew in with a helicopter to get in there, but there are teams of paleontologists that are working in that site now. They drop their camps in by helicopter, and they're finding extraordinary fossils and new species at a rate of several per year just from that one site. So North America is a dinosaur factory for lots of reasons, but it really is a fabulous place to be a paleontologist.
There seems to be a lot coming out of China these days. Is that because there is a renewed focus and emphasis on looking for dinosaur species?
Yeah, you know, China's also got much of China's arid. Much of China's had a similar kind of history of deposition and uplift. And since the wall came down, there's been a big push for paleontology in China as well. So lots of people looking. And there was good paleontology even when it was a communist country, but they do have some extraordinary sites there. I mean, there are five major dinosaur-producing countries in the world. It's Argentina, United States, Canada, China, and Mongolia. Those are the five countries where most of the world's dinosaurs have come from.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Arnie in Dallas. Hi, Arnie. Arnie, are you with us? Okay, we will move on, and we will speak this time to Michelle. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I'm calling from Grapevine in Dallas, and you alluded to it a little earlier. Archaeologists find buried middens, buried settlements, and a whole bit, and that's how they often date. At what point will our garbage be rocks that future geologists use to date?
Oh, that's a good question. When are we going to leave a fossil record? So the way something becomes a rock is it gets buried, and then it keeps getting buried deeper and deeper and deeper. And again, back to my New Orleans analogy, New Orleans is sinking pretty fast in a geologic sense, and if you drilled a hole beneath New Orleans, you can go down tens of thousands of feet and only go back in time about 10 million years. So you're looking at a place that's sinking so rapidly that eventually you get down to a depth where the pressure and temperature changes the sediments and compacts them and sometimes cements them together and makes them into rock. So to become a rock, you need a little bit of burial pressure and temperature and time. It's sort of like cooking up a brownies or something like that.
If it was a strike from space that killed the dinosaurs, do we know exactly where the impact was?
Yeah, you know, we really do. It's an amazing story. This idea first came out in June of 1980, and we all thought asteroid killed the dinosaurs. That's completely National Enquirer science. But the guys that proposed the theory were actually really, really smart guys from Berkeley, and they had enough data to make a testable hypothesis. And we went out and started looking for other places where there was, they discovered this thin layer of rock, very thin, a few millimeters thick, but it had a bunch of debris from an asteroid. And we started finding that layer all around the world. So the question was, where is the crater? And in 1990, it was located on the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico near the town of Merida. And it's a big crater. It's 120 miles wide and a couple of miles deep. And when the asteroid hit that thing, it probably made a hole that for a moment or two was maybe 25, 35 miles deep.
Wow.
And then all that stuff blew out of the hole. It would have been a horrible time to be in Texas because you would have had tsunamis, gigantic explosions a billion times the size of Hiroshima. You would have had earthquakes of magnitude 13. You would have chunks of Mexico flying and landing in Texas. I mean, it was one of the most spectacular things that's ever happened on planet Earth, and it happened in a way that caused not only just the dinosaurs, but basically any animal bigger than a house cat didn't survive that event.
Where is the mass of that asteroid? Could you drill down and get a lot of asteroid bits?
No, what happened is when asteroids come in, they are so big and they're moving so fast, they have tremendous energy, but they hit the Earth, which is much bigger and not moving. It's like driving a truck into a wall. The truck's going to bounce back. And what happens is the asteroid transfers its energy into the Earth and it melts the target rock and vaporizes the asteroid. And then all that molten target rock and the vaporized asteroid gets ejected and blown back out of the crater and blown into low Earth orbit. And then some of it will rain back in through the atmosphere and heat up on reentry, and you get this nice broiler oven effect as the reentering ejecta coming back through the atmosphere heats the sky again to add insult and more injury to the injury that was already there.
I hope I never see it, but that is just really cool.
Exactly.
We're speaking...
You can watch it on the show. It's
right.
Much better.
The animation works much better. We're speaking with Kirk Johnson. He directs the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, and he hosts the new three-part NOVA series, Making North America. Part 2 continues tonight on KERA Television. You can join this conversation by emailing us, think@kera.org. The phone number is 1-800-933-5372, and I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. There's a three-part NOVA series, which is airing tonight in its second edition. It's called NOVA, Making North America. The host of that program is Kirk Johnson, who is also director of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, and he is my guest this hour. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Kirk, you mentioned earlier that the dinosaurs were all killed by this asteroid impact pretty quickly. Why was it that smaller animals, notably things like small mammals, at least were, some of them were able to survive?
We don't know for sure, but here's what we do know. We do know that we find above the layer that has the asteroid debris, we find no more dinosaurs. There's lots of dinosaurs and then they're gone. But above the layer, we find turtles, we find alligators, we find fish, and we find small-bodied mammals, and we find little birds. So the two things that are characteristic of everything that survives seems to be either you have a small body or you lived in fresh water. So if you had life in fresh water or if you're small, maybe lived in burrows. So the idea is that a big event happens. It knocks down all the forests, burns the forests, basically destroys the vegetation. And then there's dust in the air for 3 or 4 months, which blocks out the sunlight, which kills photosynthesis, which stops green plants from growing. So if you're a big herbivore, if the blast didn't get you, starvation will. And if you're a big animal, you need lots of space, lots of food, and you got to find the other big animals. Whereas if you're something the size of a mouse, you might be living in your burrow and not even notice it and come back out 4 months and go, oh, look, where'd all the dinosaurs go?
Life is much more pleasant now.
Yeah, exactly. And then what's so amazing is that the animals that are left start to evolve quite rapidly. Within about 3 million years of the asteroid impact, we have dinosaur-sized mammals for the first time. So mammals get big only after the dinosaurs are gone.
We have an email here from Erica in Paul's Valley, Oklahoma, who writes, "Sometimes I think we're going to mine all of the granite for countertops and eat all of the salt. I know this is irrational, and it's probably because it's so hard to think about the differences in scale. Can you help me think about this more rationally?"
You know, it's an interesting question. How much of the earth can we as humans consume? Because there are a lot more of us now than there were when I was born. I mean, there's 7.2 billion humans on the planet now, and there were 3 billion when I was born 55 years ago. So we're having more mouths, there's more countertops and more salt eating going on. But the planet's a big place. I mean, just North America is 10 million square miles, and the volume of the rock beneath our feet is immense. The places the continental crust is 30 miles thick. So, you know, there's plenty of rock down there and there's a lot of salt down there. But it's a fair question to ask, where do we sort of aim for our resource use to be? And we get into that in the third episode. We talk a little bit about oil and gas and about coal and gold and iron and soil, all these things that are so important for us and our culture and our civilization. And we'd be in pretty big trouble if we didn't have them. But there's also issues that go along with using them, whether it's the mining or the adding carbon to the atmosphere. So it's a complicated world we live in, and one of the goals of the show is to get people thinking about the geology that supports them, because this is our planet, and this is what we have.
We talk all the time about resources like, you know, fossil fuels and even things like precious metals. I love the idea of soil as precious as it is because, you know, we have expressions in Texas like common as dirt. But in fact, good topsoil takes a long time to form and doesn't last forever.
Oh, yeah. And you have to take care of your soil. I mean, any good farmer knows that. That's the whole rotation of the crops and things. And we film an episode in a tobacco field in North Carolina. And you can see really what happened was, even by the time George Washington was paying attention, he was saying, boy, the soils are getting pretty trashed by this tobacco. We're probably going to have to move west to get the better soils. And so in part what caused the western expansion of the United States was people moving for more fertile lands. And they found this incredible Midwest, which has the soils that are formed by the dust blowing off the south side of these immense ice sheets that covered North America 15,000 years ago. And it's some of the most incredible soils in the world. Places like Iowa have just phenomenal soil. It's a real attribute, a real resource of this nation.
Let's go back to the phones. This time we'll speak with Caleb in Fort Worth. Hi, Caleb.
Hey, fascinating discussion. I had a comment. I was actually hiking in Longhorn Park on Monday and found dozens of examples of ammonite fossils. So just wanted to share that. But I also had a question about the Ouachita and Ozark Mountains in Arkansas. And
yep,
they're so vastly different from each other. I was wondering if you could kind of explain that and if the New Madrid Fault has anything to do or its role in the formation.
Well, now you're dipping back into my regional geology, but the Ouachitas and those mountain ranges are part of a trend. It's sort of the extension of the southern trend of the Appalachians. And then there's also this interesting fact that when those mountains are forming, that the trend actually continued up into what's southern Colorado. So if you go to places like the Uncompahgres of Colorado, that's an extension of that trend. I can't specifically answer your question about the difference between the Ouachitas and the Ozarks, but the way to get the answer is to look at a geologic map. And these maps are published by the state geological surveys or by the U.S. Geological Survey, or often you can go to local museums and see the geologic map. And usually what makes the mountains different is the rock that makes them is different from place to place. And the geologic map will sort that right out for you.
Let's speak this time to Charlene in Arlington. Hi, Charlene.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a native Nevadan, and from age 10 to age 14, my dad and I used to go up into the Black Rock Desert where they have lots of black opals, and we actually filed a claim. But we also were looking for pretty rocks, and we'd tramp all over the desert. And as I got older and learned a little more about geology and geography, I could never understand why there is oil in California and there's oil in Utah and there's oil other places that were part of the prehistoric Lake Lahontan, but they have never found, to my knowledge, oil in Nevada.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, and you basically point out that where you are in geology really matters. And both in California and in the areas of the Colorado Plateau and the areas around Colorado and Wyoming, you had great big areas where the land sank and lots of marine planting got buried and made great big thick layers of shale, which is the source rock for oil and gas. That stuff got heated and cooked, and the oil formed, and it's still there and being drilled today. In Nevada, you've got this very interesting landscape called the Basin and Range, and it's an area where Nevada is literally being pulled apart. And you pull something apart, you get a bunch of north-south cracks called faults. And if you look at any map of Nevada, you'll see that it's just hundreds of little north-south mountain ranges. And that's a very different kind of environment than the environment that was happening in the oil depositing times in the Rockies or in California. So, you know, where you are really matters. And Nevada is a great state for rock hounds, I'll tell you that much.
Are mountain ranges any more likely to form north to south than east to west or in a diagonal fashion?
No, they're really pretty much, they form relative to the stresses that make them. So if you think about mountains like the Alps, which are more or less east-west because Africa's driving into Europe, or the Himalayas, which are east-west because India's driving into Asia. So they're really a response to the forces. But in North America, we have these great more or less north-south trends, the Cordillera on the west side and the Appalachian trend on the east side. But even in the Rocky Mountains, there are mountain ranges like the Wind River Mountains of Wyoming, which are northwest, southeast, and the Uinta Mountains of Utah, which are east and west. So mountains basically form in response to the forces that are making them and which direction those forces are coming from. So there's no real trick to north, south, east, west.
Let's jump back on the phones here. We have Carrie on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Hey, I saw the first episode of the show on Channel 13 last week, and I loved it, and I love the show. It's great. The question I have is, with your audience here in Dallas and Fort Worth, there are thousands of people who may be listening right now who don't believe that the Earth is older than 6,000 years old. That's very frustrating for me. What is it that you can say to that portion of your audience to maybe make to help them understand that the Earth really is older than 6,000 years?
Well, I think, you know, really the way to tackle that problem, and I spend a lot of time with creationists or friends of mine and stuff, and we talk a lot about it. They're very curious about how I know what I know. And there are two sources of information, and the estimation of the Earth being 6,000 years old is an interpretation of basically genealogies in the Bible where numbers are applied. And there's a lot of religions that don't even think that the Earth is 6,000 years old. They think it's as old as geologists think it is. So it's sort of a theological interpretation to say the Earth is 6,000 years old. But I'm not really here to argue theology. I'm more here to argue geology. And the thing to do is take them on a hike. Go, you know, make some friends with people who think the Earth is 6,000 years old and go to the Grand Canyon and talk your way through it and see if you can actually have a reasoned conversation about how did this place get here? Because at the end of the day, we're all asking the same big questions, is where do we come from and how do we get here? And I think that geology is one of the best ways to actually start to answer that question.
How does it happen that in some parts of the world, including Texas, things like dinosaur tracks have been preserved as solid rock? You know, tracks seem to us to be such a temporary thing.
Right, because, you know, you're used to seeing tracks when you walk on the beach. And when you walk on the beach and you leave the tracks, the next wave wipes away the tracks, and you think that would never preserve.
Right.
But change your perspective a little bit and think walking across a big, muddy field. Your tracks, you leave these big tracks in the mud, and then the mud actually dries and it hardens. And if that was in a landscape that was sinking, maybe the next layer of sand that comes in would actually fill in those holes in the hardened mud. And in fact, that's the way most good tracks are preserved, is that they're not just pure sand. They're actually got some mud in the sand. And the mud holds the sand together when the track is made long enough so you can bury the entire track. And dinosaur tracks turn out to be one of the most common fossils in the American West. I used to claim that I could spot them out of the car window at 65 miles an hour. They were so common. And they really are just everywhere. You talk to dinosaur people, like, yeah, there's tracks all over the place. And what's rare is when you find them exposed on a horizontal surface, because you have to bury the surface and then expose it again in the same way. You often find them in cross-section because erosion's cut them in half and things. But those sites where you find them on horizontal surfaces are pretty amazing because you can actually just see those three-toed things marching across the landscape. They're everywhere.
How has imaging equipment changed what geologists do, the ability to sort of know what's underground before they break ground?
Oh, it's great. Remote sensing has been fabulous for geology at any scale, really. We're looking at trying to figure out what the deep layers of the Earth are like by using remote sensors that are actually catching the waves generated by earthquakes. We're using all sorts of seismic devices, whether they're sort of thumper trucks or explosions that send sound waves down into the ground and back up. And you can image stuff that's tens of thousands of feet down. But you can also use surface imaging now, things like LIDAR, which measure very precisely the shape of the surface. You can even fly a plane over a forest with a LIDAR and then subtract the trees and see the ground beneath the trees and see faults and surface like that in the trees. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful couple of decades for geology. And I think one of the great things is GPS devices, the same thing you have in your phone and your car. Geologists love those things because you know exactly where you are. And GPS devices in Europe and North America actually show that the continents actually are moving apart from each other, even as we speak. And we're measuring it with our GPS devices.
And we're moving at about, what, I think in the doc you say, at the rate that our fingernails grow?
Yeah, it's a nice analogy because people have different rates of fingernail growth and continents move at different rates as well. But, you know, if you chew your fingernails, you get a pretty good sense of geologic time.
Do you have a favorite geological phenomenon, like something that makes for really good dinner party conversation?
Oh, man, that's, you know, I do like volcanic ash falls because volcanoes erupt in lots of different ways. Sometimes they send out lava that runs down the hill like Kilauea, but sometimes they explode and make this powdery rock dust that rains down on the landscape. And there are many examples of gigantic volcanoes in the past that have blown up and rained down lots of dust on the landscape. So you get, you know, 4, 5, 10 feet of dust. And imagine if 4, 10 feet of dust fell on Dallas today. You'd have a very nice fossilized version of Dallas. And that's happened many times in the geologic past. And as a paleontologist, I just love places like that. And maybe the best fossil site in North America is in this little tiny place of northeastern Nebraska called Ash Fall. And there's a herd of rhinoceroses and horses that were buried and killed by this ash fall deposit. And they're just lying there today. You can see mother and baby rhinoceroses. Every single bone is intact. I mean, these animals literally were suffocated by the ash and buried and left as perfect fossils because of that volcanic eruption. So there's a great example where geology didn't work out so well for those guys.
It worked out well for us today, discovering those things.
Exactly.
Kirk Johnson is the SANT Director of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History and host of Making North America. The three-part PBS Nova series continues tonight on KERA-TV. Kirk, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Go see museums.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Lauren Aguirre. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. If you want to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.